Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Pleasant good day to you all. Here. Now you can see the beautiful tie that my wife bought me. No, I need this to see my notes and to read. Any gentlemen here that would like to take off their coats, I know it's a really hot day, you can go ahead and do that. I've always wanted to say that. It's, 85 going to be today? In the middle of February? It all sounds good, except it's going to chase away our snowbirds who we really like and we want them to stay. We don't want them leaving us because of our warm weather anyway. The Apostle John wrote his gospel towards the end of the first century, decades after the life, the death, and the resurrection of Christ. During the time between John witnessed what Jesus did as one of his disciples, and when he eventually wrote his gospel, John no doubt thought a lot about what he was going to write. He probably compiled a list of events that he wanted to include. He no doubt wrote down quotes that Jesus actually said so that he could, to the best of his memory, write them down accurately. He probably made his gospel account as accurate as possible. He had to feel an enormous responsibility as one of the actual witnesses to be as true in his work as he could be. And when he was finished writing his work, he read it, and then he felt compelled to add something to it. If you'll turn with me to John 21, the end of the Gospel of John here, John 21, and we'll start reading, well, we will read verse 24. John 21, 24. John adds, "This is the disciple who testifies concerning these things and who wrote these things, and we know his testimony is true." John wanted everyone who would eventually read this work to know that it was as accurate as it could possibly be. He wanted us to know that it was authentic, that it was true, that he, as an eyewitness, had written it. And there should be no question as to its authentic origin. And then he adds in the next verse, verse 25, "But there were also many other things that Jesus did, which, if they were written one by one, I do not suppose that even the world itself could contain the books that would be written." Have you ever wondered what else Jesus did? Have you ever pondered about all the individual healings that Jesus performed, how they affected those involved, not only the people that were actually healed, but their family members who were taking care of them, whether they were blind or deaf or crippled? Have you ever meditated on the other miracles that Jesus did that are not included in these gospel accounts specifically? Apparently there were many. How did they affect his followers? How did they affect his disciples? How did they react when they saw these things? So many incidents that there may not have been enough parchment at the time to write them all down. Turn back to Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. Matthew 4, verse 23, Matthew in this verse tries to summarize some of these events all in one verse. Matthew 4, verse 23, and Jesus went through all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every bodily ailment among the people. How many of these incidents occurred in this one sentence? Matthew sums up what could have been dozens and dozens of individual healings and miracles in one short verse. Verse 24. Then his fame went out into all Syria, and they brought to him all who were sick, oppressed by various diseases and torments, and possessed by demons and lunatics and those that were paralyzed, and he healed them. And great multitudes followed him from Galilee to Decapolis and Jerusalem and Judea and beyond the Jordan. Yes, have you ever wondered about all that Jesus did? All that he accomplished that we actually don't have a written record of specifically? Apparently there was much that Jesus did that we can only wonder about, that we can only surmise or speculate on. Now, there's a saying that has been popular in mainstream Christianity in recent years. WWJD. What would Jesus do? Well, we know he did many things. Now, personally, and this is just a personal thing, I'm not requiring you all to do it too, but personally, I cringe at the use of the term because I don't think it's the correct question. I don't think it's the question that should be asked. First of all, let's go back to the origin of the question, WWJD. In 1896, that's 120 years ago, 1896, a book was written titled Walking in His Steps. It was written by a liberal theologian at the time by the name of Charles Sheldon. And the book taught that Jesus was a spiritual liberal. Now, I suppose if you could convince people that Jesus shared your views and was just like you, well, it might validate and give your opinion some credibility, right? In the book, he asked the question, what would Jesus do? And it implied that we too should live our lives as Jesus did. Now, that doesn't sound all that bad, does it? In the 1990s, the phrase was adopted in a marketing campaign. Millions of wristbands were produced with WWJD on them. WWJD became a popular mantra in the evangelical Christian community. And since then, in recent years, other liberal activists have adopted the phrase. The Occupy Wall Street protesters have used it. Kathy and I were actually in New York City a couple years ago. We were walking from the World Trade Center over to Wall Street, and we were walking up the street, and there, across the street was this large park. And there were police all around the park. There were emergency vehicles. There were television news coverage of this, what was going on in the park. And at one end of the park, there was drums beating and people chanting. And on the other end of the park, there was a stage set up with a microphone, someone giving a speech. And throughout the park, you could see all these protesters. And I asked our tour guide, what is this? He says, oh, it's the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street protesters. They had a bunch of posters and a bunch of signs, including, what would Jesus do? I remember during the Bush presidency, the anti-war protesters asking the same question with their signs. What would Jesus do? I think it's the wrong question. Today, we will look at what Jesus did do. And then we will ask a little different question, one that for us in the Church of God makes, well, it makes more sense and is more relevant to our Christian lives. First of all, let me ask what I consider a logical question. Can we do what Jesus did? Can anyone here turn water into wine? Don't see a hand. You'd be my best friend. No, actually, I prefer scotch, but... Can we heal the sick? Can we resurrect the dead? Can we perform miracles? Can we feed thousands with a couple loaves and fishes? Can we walk on water? Jesus did those things. And if we are to do as Jesus did, well, we're falling a little short, aren't we? It has been said by some that Jesus was not involved in politics. I'd like to look at the written record. To compare, first of all, to compare the politics at the time of Christ with what we have here today in the United States, it's like comparing apples and, pick an exotic fruit, guavas or watermelon or something, because it's that different. Jesus lived in Judea during a time of Roman occupation. They did not have the freedoms that we enjoy here today. However, Rome allowed the Jewish community to have their religious hierarchy. They were allowed to continue their religious traditions. Rome allowed them to do this as the religious leaders had control over the behavior of the people. And as long as there was peace among the people, well, the Romans, they just stayed out of their religious business. The only politics being practiced at the time of Christ was religious politics. Now, we're in a political season at this time. You've seen it on the news, no doubt. There's primaries going on. There are a lot of speeches being given. Advertising is being, a lot of millions of dollars in advertising being spent back east. It's coming this way. We haven't really had to watch it yet, but we will. It's a long season. We've got another 9 months of it. We better get used to it. We know and we talk about dirty politics. And we've seen a little in the news, if you've been paying attention, if you've been watching. Dirty politics. Well, there's nothing worse than dirty religious politics. And that's what was going on during the time of Christ's ministry. Turn over a few pages to Matthew 12. Matthew 12, verse 22. Then was brought to him, to Jesus, one who was possessed of a demon, blind and dumb. And Jesus healed him, so that the one who had been blind and dumb both spoke and saw. Jesus did that. 23. And the multitudes were all amazed and said, "Is this the son of David?" They were amazed that he could do this. 24, and when the Pharisees heard this, they said, "Well, this man does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the prince of demons." The Pharisees. Who were the Pharisees? They were a religious political party. Look it up. Google it. Wikipedia it. They say the Pharisees were a religious political party at the time of Christ. And how did Jesus respond to them and their accusations? Verse 33, skip down a few verses to verse 33. Jesus makes an analogy. Try to make it easier for them to understand. Either make the tree good and the fruit good, or make the tree corrupt and the fruit corrupt. For a tree is known by its fruit. A sick tree, a bad tree, will not usually produce good fruit. And usually good fruit does come from a good, healthy tree. Verse 34, offspring of vipers, how are you able to speak good things being evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. He calls them what they were. Snakes in the grass, basically. Serpents. You know, here out west, we'd call them sidewinders. Vipers. That were a political threat to the freedom of the citizens living there at the time. Jesus preached a lot about freedom. Why? Well, not only were they being occupied in that area by the Roman army, but they were also occupied by a corrupt religious system. Jesus spoke out against it. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why liberal theologians and liberal political movements have adopted the WWJD phrase. Jesus spoke out against the establishment, just like they do. Turn over a few more pages to Matthew 23. Matthew 23, starting in verse 1. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have sat down on Moses' seat as judges." Now, we know who the Pharisees were, but who are these scribes? Well, the scribes, as the name might give you a clue, were professional writers. They were copyists. They were bookmen. They were the interpreters of the sacred writings of the Old Testament. And they were considered wise teachers during that time. And they were part of the religious political machine of that time. Jesus said they sit in Moses' seat. How did they get there? How did they get their authority? It was from man. Their authority was not given by God. They were chosen by men, and dirty politics was involved. Verse 3. Therefore, Jesus instructs them here, "Therefore, every judgment that they tell you to observe," these scribes and Pharisees, "observe to do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and do not. And they bind heavy burdens and hard to bear and lay them on the shoulders of men, but they will not move them with one of their own fingers." These religious leaders at that time exerted dominion over the people. They abused their position of authority over the people to control them. They took freedom away from the people. And that is why Jesus spoke so freely and so often about freedom. Excuse me a second. Verse 5. And they do all their works to be seen by man. They make broad their phylacteries, they enlarge the border of their garments. And they love the first place in the suppers and the chief seats in the synagogue. Years ago, we used to meet in a synagogue. Remember those chairs up on the stage? You know, the people that attend there in the synagogue, or for the synagogue, and that's where they want to be, up there on the stage in the chief seats. 7, and the salutations in the marketplace. To be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. That's what they want. But you are not to be called Rabbi, for one is your master, the Christ, and all of you are brethren. Also, do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your Father who is in heaven. Neither be called master, for one is your master, the Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever shall exalt himself shall be humbled, and whoever shall humble himself shall be exalted. A subject covered in the sermonette. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and as a pretext you offer prayers of great length. Because of this, you shall receive the greater judgment. He continues to address these scribes and Pharisees. Verse 14, woe, you hypocrites. 15, woe, you hypocrites. 16, woe, you blind guides. 17, you fools and blind. This is him. This is Jesus talking to the scribes and Pharisees. 23, woe, you hypocrites. 24, blind guides. 25, woe, you hypocrites. 26, blind Pharisees. 27, woe, you hypocrites. 29, woe, you hypocrites. And finally in 33, you serpents, you offspring of vipers, how will you escape the judgment of Gehenna? This was Jesus calling out the political religious leaders of the time. This was Jesus identifying the problems in the system. This was Jesus calling a spade a spade. This was Jesus condemning these scribes and Pharisees for their dirty politics. In fact, as I read this, I would conclude that Jesus Christ was political in a way. He could not run for office or join a party or vote like people do today, but he was knowledgeable of what kind of religious leaders that they had at the time, and he made a point of condemning their actions. Jesus was not afraid to enter the political fray. Now, quite frankly, I am offended that some would hijack the words of Jesus and call him a liberal. To pervert what he said and to give themselves credibility. Personally, I would consider Jesus more of a conservative, a law and order type. The liberal political party in this country today has a platform that supports abortion, the homosexual lifestyle, same-sex marriage. They have positions that they defend that I just don't see Jesus Christ supporting. But the God of this world has, deceived this whole world, and I suppose we shouldn't be surprised. It is very unfortunate that we find in our current political system some who claim to be conservative, some who elicit the name of God, who are as hypocritical as the scribes and Pharisees at the time of Christ. And it gives conservatives a bad name. It's no wonder this is not our Father's society. This is not our time, though we know it will come. What would Jesus do? It's the wrong question. In doing research for this topic, I Googled the book Walking in His Steps. I Googled the author, Charles Sheldon, and WWJD. I found it interesting that, for me, the first article that came up I don't know if I tried it again, if the same article would come up the second time, or if you tried it. You know how Google is. But the first article that came up was by a church organization we're very familiar with. The article was written by a group who has a different name now, but the same people we broke away from back in 1995. And they were extolling the virtue of the book, the author, and the WWJD mantra. What would Jesus do? It's the wrong question. The correct question for us as followers of Christ is, what did Jesus tell us to do? What did he instruct his followers to do? Well, right here in Matthew 23, we just read actual instructions from Jesus. Do not follow the examples of the political religious leaders. Because they were corrupt. Because they were hypocritical. Do not seek the chief seats. How many in this society are guilty of that? Do not seek to be called rabbi. Do not call anyone on earth father. How many millions of people do that on a regular basis around the world? What did Jesus say to do? Humble yourself. Do not seek to exalt yourself. We just read it. What did Jesus tell us to do? Turn over to that Gospel of John we talked about at the beginning here. John chapter 5. Start reading in verse 1. John 5, verse 1. And after these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And there is in Jerusalem, at the Sheep Gate, a pool called Bethesda, in the Hebrew, and it has five porches. And in these five porches were laying a great multitude of those who were sick, blind and lame and withered. And they were waiting for the stirring of the water. The stirring of the water. For several years there, once a year, always at the same time of year, it was well known that there was a miraculous movement of the water. The tradition was that an angel of God reached down into the water and stirred it with his hand. And then the first person to enter the water at the movement of the water was healed of whatever infirmity he had. Not the second person, not the third person, only the first person that jumped in or rolled in or got pushed in. However he got in at the movement of the water, he was healed, the first one. I don't know how many years that this went on. Doesn't say. But it was a well-known tradition at this time. Verse 4. For from time to time, an angel descended into the pool and agitated the water. And the first one who entered after the agitation of the water was made well from whatever disease he had. Now, a certain man was there who had been suffering with an infirmity for 38 years. He didn't say he went to the pool for 38 years. He'd just been suffering with an infirmity for 38 years. And Jesus is walking along and he sees him lying there. And knowing that he'd been there a long time, said to him, interesting question. Do you desire to be made whole? And the infirmed man answered him, Sir, I do not have anyone to put me in the pool. For after the water has been agitated, but while I'm trying to get in the water, while I'm trying to go, another one steps down before me. Can you try to picture this scene here? This pool with these five porches and I don't know how many people. It might have been dozens and dozens. It might have been 100. people laying around on these five porches and maybe as close to the water as they can get, and they're all intently looking at the water, waiting. They might have been there yesterday. You don't know when it's going to happen. They're probably planning on being there tomorrow if it doesn't happen today, and they're watching. And as soon as it moves, they're all going to jump in. He must have been very frustrated knowing that if he were to be first in the water, he would be healed. But because of his condition, year after year, he's unable to make it to the water first. No one's there to help him. Kind of a fruitless endeavor to show up every year, wanting, watching, waiting. And then he sees it and he's unable to move and get into the water. And someone always beats him to it. And Jesus has mercy on him. Verse 8, Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your bedroll and walk." And immediately the man was made whole and he stood up. And he took his bedroll and he walked. Now here's the rub. Now this day was a Sabbath. I find it interesting, though, that Jesus did not heal everyone. He could have. He could have walked up to that pool, seen the multitudes all around with all their infirmities. He could have said, "You're all healed." He had the power, he had the ability, but doesn't say he did that. He just chose this one man. Verse 10, "For this reason the Jews said to the man who had been healed, 'Hey, it's the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for you to take up your bedroll.'" Remember, the Jews had a number of rules about the Sabbath. I mean, a large number, something like 600 different little rules that you had to go by. A Sabbath day journey. You couldn't walk but just so far on the Sabbath. And you certainly couldn't carry something as bulky as your bedroll like this guy did. And the Jews nailed him on it. "Hey, what are you doing? This is the Sabbath." Verse 11, "And he answered them, 'Well, the one who made me whole said to me, take up your bedroll and walk. You know me. I've been laying there for 38 years. I can't walk. But this guy came along and he healed me. And he said, take up your bedroll and walk. The least I could do is to do what he told me to do.'" Then they asked him, "Well, who is the one who said to you, take up your bedroll and walk?" And he looked around and he says, "Oh, the man who had healed me, I don't know who he was." For Jesus had moved away and the crowd was in the place. So he disappeared. He couldn't even point him out to them. He just moved on. 14. "After these things, Jesus found him in the temple." Now, it doesn't say if it's that afternoon, that evening, or a week later. It doesn't say how long. But later, Jesus found this guy he healed in the temple. And he said to him, "Behold, you have been made whole. Sin no more, so that something worse does not happen to you." Well, the man went away and he found those Jews and he said, "Hey, I know who did this to me. I know who healed me. It was that Jesus of Nazareth. He made me whole." And for this cause, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. You know, poor guy, 38 years like that. You'd think if they had any compassion or any empathy at all, they would have rejoiced with him. But no, because it happened on the Sabbath, it nullified it in their minds. Verse 17, "But Jesus answered them." He said something very interesting. He said, "My Father is working until now, and I work." And so this, on account of this saying, the Jews sought all the more to kill him. Not only because he had loosed the Sabbath. Well, he didn't really loose the Sabbath, right? He just kind of exposed their overbearing traditions. But also because he called God his own Father, making himself equal to God. Who were these Jews? They were the political religious authorities at that time. And they could not do what Jesus did. They could not heal the sick. They could not perform miracles. They could not raise the dead. They saw the success Jesus had. They saw the great multitudes following him, waiting for every word he said. They considered Jesus a threat to their positions, a threat to their livelihood, a threat to their corrupt system, a threat to their power and authority. And their solution? Let's kill him. Why? Because they could not do what Jesus did. And you know the rest of the story. Through their lies and treachery, they did ultimately have him killed. One of the most concentrated list of instructions from Jesus to his followers is found in the Sermon on the Mount. These are the heart and core of the teachings of Jesus Christ. If you'll turn with to Matthew 5 with me, Matthew 5, starting in verse 1. The Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, verse 1. But seeing the multitudes, he went up into the mountain and he sat down. His disciples came to him and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, He opened his mouth. When this phrase is used in the original Greek, it refers to a tone of being solemn, of being grave, of being serious, of being dignified. These following words were weighty words from the mind and heart of Jesus Christ. These words were meant not to be taken lightly. The hearer of that time and the reader now has a solemn responsibility to hear and to obey these words. Jesus begins in verse 3 with the Beatitudes. You're familiar with this chapter, with the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are Christian traits that Jesus lists and tells us that we are blessed if we possess them. He talks about poor in spirit and those who mourn and those that are meek, those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, those who are merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. The Beatitudes. Verse 12. Rejoice and be filled with joy, for great is your reward in heaven. This is Jesus talking. If we have these Beatitudes evident in our lives, we will be blessed in this life, and he promises we will be rewarded at the return of Christ. 13. Jesus tells his followers, You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, with what shall it be salted? For it no longer has any strength, but is to be thrown out and to be trampled upon by man. We are the salt of the earth. You and I are the salt of the earth. You know, of all the ingredients in our diet, salt is proportionately just a very small part. Just a pinch or a sprinkle is all that is needed to do the job of enhancing the flavor of our food. And Jesus calls us, as an analogy, the salt of the earth. You know, in the whole world, there aren't very many of us. I've always wondered about that, why. But apparently God For the job that God has called us to do, there only needs to be a relative few, like salt in proportion to our regular diet. But like salt, we need to be potent, we need to be effective, we need to be productive to be successful. And if we're not, well, we are as useless to God as stale salt. 14. He says again, you are the light of the world. In a city that is set on a mountain cannot be hid, neither do they light a lamp and put it under a bushel basket, but on a lampstand, and it shines for all who are in the house. In the same way also, you are to let your light shine before men. Light exposes danger that cannot be seen in darkness. This world is in spiritual darkness. Yet we have been called to let our light shine in this darkened world. And as the work of God, in addition to proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom of God, we should be warning this world of the dangers that are out there and the dangers that are in not only our future, but the world's future. 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Jesus did not come to do away with the law. Have you ever heard anything different? What did Jesus tell his followers? I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Jesus Christ to show how the law should be perfectly lived. Jesus kept the law perfectly. And he kept it in the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. 20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, there is no way that you shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. Yeah, the scribes and Pharisees were really righteous. I mean, they didn't even get close to breaking the letter of the law. The scribes and Pharisees kept a strict, outward, literal keeping of the law, but they missed the spirit of the law. And for us to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees and how they kept the law, well, we need to keep both the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. We need to seek the righteousness of God, not the self-righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Jesus continues his teachings in this Sermon on the Mount. He explains in the next few verses that as New Testament Christians, murder begins in the heart or the mind. Additionally, he instructs that adultery begins in the heart, in the mind. Verse 31, he explains that marriage is sacred and binding. Verse 33, he forbids oaths. How many oaths are taken around the world on a daily basis? What did Jesus tell us to do? 38, he encourages us to go the second mile. 43, he instructs us to love our enemies. Love your enemies. Now, we don't go, as Christians, we don't go out trying to make enemies, right? But on occasion, people behave in a way that, well, they become our enemies, or we become their enemies, or however it works. They may sin grievously against us. They may do something at work, set you up, lie about you. It's not always easy to love your enemies, is it? That's something I struggle with. But he told us to do it. In Matthew 6, the next chapter, the Sermon on the Mount continues. Let's pick it up in verse 5. Jesus says, "And when you pray, you shall not be as the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, in order that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you pray, enter into a private room, and after shutting the door, pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees you in secret shall reward you openly. And when you pray, do not use vain repetitions, as the heathen do, for they think that by multiplying their words they shall be heard." How many people do this? What did Jesus tell us to do? Verse 8. "Now then, do not be like them, for your Father knows what things you have need of before you even ask Him. In fact, He might know our needs before we even realize what our needs are, before we can even ask them. Therefore, you are to pray after this manner: Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name." Jesus pointed us to the Father. When Jesus prayed, he prayed to the Father. And we know the role of Jesus Christ in our Christian lives. We know what he does now. He's our intercessor. Our prayers go through him and right by him as he sits at the right hand of God the Father. As we pray to God the Father, Christ is aware of it. And there are times we may want to acknowledge Christ there at God's, the Father's right hand. There may be times when we ask him for a little help. You used to be a human, or you were a human for a while. You know what it's like to be tempted. You, although you were perfect, but maybe you can put in a good word for me here. Because it's tough. It's hard. But we don't pray to Jesus Christ. How many people today offer their prayers to Jesus? How many offer their prayers to his mother, Mary, the Virgin Mary? How many offer prayers to various saints? Is that what Jesus said to do? No, it was very simple here. Verse 9, "Therefore, you are to pray after this manner: Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name." Very simple instruction. What did Jesus tell us to do? Verse 16, Jesus tells us how to fast. Verse 19, he tells us where to lay up our treasures. 24, Jesus explains that we can't have two masters, God and money. Can't. If you try to work for them both, neither one of them will. Well, one will take over the other. 25, Jesus tells us not to worry. You know, some of us worry when we don't have anything to worry about. In chapter 7, the sermon continues. Jesus tells us not to judge. Oh, we're to have righteous judgment. We're just not to be judgmental in a way that could come back on us. In verse 7, he instructs us to ask, seek, and knock. 13, he shows us the narrow way versus the broad way. 15, Jesus tells us how to identify false prophets, which is going to be very important to know in our future. Verse 21, Jesus warns that to some, he will say at his return, "I'm sorry, I never knew you." who are these people? Well, it's not Gog and Magog who are on the battlefield there in Armageddon wanting to fight Christ at his return. No, these are religious people, Christians. People who ignored what Jesus said to do. Let's read verse 24. Matthew 7, verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine, these are the words Jesus told us to do, and practices them, I will compare him to a wise man who built his house upon a rock. And the rain came down, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not practice them shall be compared to a foolish man who built his house upon sand. And the rain came down, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. Jesus Christ is the rock which we build our lives. All these topics in this sermon were what Jesus told us to do. Verse 28. Now it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teachings. They were astonished. Why? 29. For he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. Now, I've never heard a scribe preach or teach, but there must have been a distinct contrast of styles. So much so that the people were astonished. They were amazed. He preached as one who had authority. And who gave him that authority? Where did he get that authority? God the Father gave him that authority. It was not a man. It was not a corrupt, dirty political system. He got it from God. One last example. Did Jesus tell us to celebrate his birth? I've read the Bible from cover to cover, as most of you have too. I didn't find it in there. He didn't instruct his disciples to do it, and they didn't do it. The early New Testament church didn't do it. And if we were supposed to do it, I think we'd know what day he was actually born on, right? He would have made it clear. Now, don't get me wrong, the birth of Christ is a very important event in human history. A couple sermons ago, I spoke exclusively about that. Very important. But Jesus didn't tell us to celebrate his birthday. Question two, did Jesus tell us to celebrate his resurrection? It's not in the Bible. The number one Christian holiday is Christmas, and it's the celebration of his birth, right? The number two celebration, Christian celebration, is Easter. They get up early in the morning and they go to the park where they've got a stage set up, and they've got microphones and speakers, and there's a park near our house, and we'll hear them over there early on a Sunday morning. And then they go home and they hide Easter eggs and roll eggs around on the lawn and eat their hot cross buns. It's a big, big holiday. Did Jesus tell us to celebrate his resurrection? Nowhere in the Bible does it. Very important event. I'm glad it happened. What did Jesus tell us to do? He told us to memorialize his death. How many people around the world actually do that? It is largely ignored. To summarize, over a century ago, a liberal theologian wrote a book asking, "What would Jesus do?" The book tries to identify Jesus as a spiritual liberal. In the 1990s, the saying was marketed and became very popular in the evangelical Christian community. And since then, others have used it to try to bring credibility to their various causes. I think I would be very careful to not try to use the name of Jesus Christ to give credence and credibility to a particular cause or movement. I mean, how can we possibly know what Jesus would do here and now other than by recognizing and following what Jesus said to do, what he told us to do?